Hey folks, welcome back to Research in Review, where we get to discuss research papers with the scientists who wrote them. Today's episode is about drug discovery, particularly about a novel anti-malarial drug. Today's guest received his PhD in developing blood-brain barrier models from King's College London before working in drug metabolism and pharmacokinetics in the pharmaceutical industry with companies such as Huntingdon Life Sciences and GlaxoSmithKline. He then joined the University of Dundee's Drug Discovery Unit as head of this sector in 2008 and is currently the chair of quantitative pharmacology. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Kevin Reid.
Hi, good morning, Fraser.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us today. So could you start by telling us a bit about the role of the Dundee Drug Discovery Unit?
Yeah, sure. So, the Drug Discovery Unit here in Dundee has been functional now for the best part of 15 years. It started in late 2006, and it was really the brainchild of Professor Mike Ferguson and Professor Alan Fairlamb, two world-leading parasitologists who were becoming frustrated that they couldn't get engagement with the pharmaceutical industry for some of their ideas for treatments for parasitic diseases, particularly human African trypanosomiasis at the time. So they thought, okay, let's try and do this ourselves here in Dundee. So they managed to secure substantial funding from the Wellcome Trust and then worked on the idea of them bringing in pharmaceutical industry experienced people that know how to discover and develop drugs, to then put them together with the world leading biology that was already here at the university in Dundee to form the drug discovery unit. And that's how it was born. And Professor Paul Wyatt, who joined us to lead it, and then I joined in 2008 from GlaxoSmithKline. So we're running with now about 130 staff, with 70% or so are ex-pharmaceutical industry people. So we effectively operate as a biotech, you know, within the university, which is quite unique in the UK in that respect, because, you know, being fully integrated with all the different disciplines that you need to be able to take that initial drug start point, that chemical start point, and try and develop it into a drug. You know, every discipline that's required to do that is all integrated within the drug discovery unit, and we're very much focused on neglected tropical diseases. So we work in tuberculosis, in malaria, in visceral leishmaniasis, Chagas disease, cryptosporidiosis, so a range of infectious diseases of poverty, you know, that affect the poorest people in the world. And, you know, we're funded by the Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, the Medicines for Malaria Venture, for actually moving new drug treatments forward in all of these diseases. And then more recently in the DDU, we've also become more involved in more commercial diseases as well. And this is led by Professor David Gray, where we're taking novel target biology and de-risking that, and potentially also taking that forward to new drug treatments, you know, in diseases such as Alzheimer's there. And they have some collaborations with major pharmaceutical companies in that space as well. But predominantly, we're still very much focused on neglected diseases.
So could you go in a bit more about neglected tropical diseases? From my understanding and what I've learned in the past, is neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are diseases that are just not financially viable for a big pharmaceutical company to research. Is that a good definition, or are there a better definition of NTDs?
No, is there a better way of describing neglected diseases? I mean, I think, you know, historically, it's, you know, these are diseases that weren't worked on at all because of no commercial return, but also now, you know, these are the diseases that affect the poorest in society, that, you know, have no money really to be able to do a great deal in this space. And, you know, I prefer to call them sort of infectious diseases of poverty rather than neglected tropical diseases now, to be honest.
That's interesting. And as we'll go in further in your paper, one of the things you mentioned about this specific drug is that it had to be affordable. I think you used a figure of like about $1 per dose was
absolutely
was the title, which was very interesting. And moving on to something you said in the back about how a lot of people at the drug discovery unit come from industry? So from your personal experience, what's the difference between working in industry versus now in academia?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think there's pros and cons to both organisations. I think, you know, the reason I left industry, I was becoming frustrated that we were being driven more by commercial in terms of the diseases that we worked on. So, for example, I was very much involved in the central nervous system diseases while I was at Glaxo for 18 years, both in the UK and in Italy. And it was, you know, we were working on bipolar disorder, major depressive disorder, but then commercially we were forced to stop doing that and work on binge eating and other disorders that I think, you know, have an environmental consideration as well as obviously a treatment indication. And, you know, my passion for, you know, I'm very passionate about developing drugs for a range of diseases, but I have to believe in that disease in a way that to be able to deliver on it. And I think there were some challenges there in terms of how we were working on being forced to work on some diseases that maybe we weren't so comfortable with. And I think it excited me to move into neglected tropical diseases because there'd been no real effort in that before, and that was the interest to move to Dundee. So in academia, you know, you've got very, very strong basic fundamental biology built in. I think that's the key thing here. You know, often in the pharmaceutical industry, we would get a new target or a new idea, and we would drive forward very rapidly to develop a drug for that, and the biology would tend to fall behind. And actually then sometimes we would have challenges in that translation through maybe even to the animal model of disease, let alone when we get to the clinic and the translation into actually working in humans when we're in clinical trials. And I think, you know, here we have the biology on our doorstep in the parasitology that we need, so that it's actually really helped us in developing the right assays and getting hopefully the right translational approaches to actually deliver in the clinic, and as we are now doing for some of these diseases.
Thank you. And now we'll move on to your paper, and the paper we'll be looking at today is a novel multiple-stage anti-malarial agent that inhibits protein synthesis. Now, this paper was published in 2015. Where is the drug known as DD1107498 currently in development?
Yeah, so we took it all the way to a stage called candidate selection. So that's basically where you have all the properties in a molecule that you really believe that is going to be a potential new drug treatment for that disease. And the next stage is then to take it through regulatory toxicology, just to be absolutely sure that it's safe. And then you will start your clinical trials. So at the point that we released it, candidate selection, working and funded by the Medicines for Malaria venture, it was then partnered with Merck, the German Merck organization, and they've taken it through regulatory toxicology, and then it went into phase one clinical trials, which went into healthy volunteers just to confirm that it did what we expected it to do in terms of its pharmacokinetics, the way that the drug was dealt with by the body, and it stayed in the body long enough that it was hoped that it would then be able to be a good single dose treatment. And thankfully it does have good kinetics, and more importantly that it was tolerated and safe at that dose in healthy volunteers. And then as you rise the doses up to the level that you think is necessary to actually then be effective when you move into patients. So all of that work has been done. And then the beauty in malaria is that you can actually do a sort of earlier test of activity quicker than you can in the range of commercial diseases. So you can take some healthy volunteers, and save these volunteers inverted commas, that are then actually infected with malaria, and then you treat them. So you can have a sort of later phase, what we call a phase 1b trial, where you can actually get a handle on whether your drug is actually going to work before you actually go into malaria patients themselves. And that is completed, and very excitingly, you know, this compound at a single dose does actually work in this, what we call this challenge study, where healthy volunteers have been infected with malaria. Now, I will point out these people are infected with a chloroquine-sensitive malaria, so that if indeed your drug didn't work, then they can be rescued with another known drug that's already there in the field in malaria. But yes, so there's now a study ongoing to look at the prophylaxis for this drug, because it stays in the body for a very long time, so it could be used, say, for the traveller's market as a protective mechanism for avoiding malaria. It's being looked at for that, and it's also waiting for a suitable partner drug to go into actual patients now in these phase 2 clinical trials, and that's where it currently stands at the moment. So very exciting, still progressing well.
Fantastic. And just to a quick aside, you mentioned phase 1 and phase 2. How many different phases of that stage of drug development are there in terms of like clinical testing?
Yeah, the clinical phases. So there's sort of part phases within the phases, but effectively there's just the three. There's three phases. So phase 1, you have the healthy volunteers. Phase 2, you will then go into a small cohorts of actual patients. And then phase 3, we have a much broader population of patients. But then indeed, once you then get marketing approval, you're still monitoring that drug as it then goes forward, in any disease, in much bigger cohorts of patients as well, just in case anything that you've not picked up from your safety studies or that starts to raise its head, because although you do your best to have the perfect drug, it's never quite works out that way, and so it's always important to monitor as you go forward, just in case. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's great that the drug is developing well, but how many successful ones have you had compared to how many ones that haven't worked out? Like, what's the ratio around?
You need to be an optimist in drug discovery and development. I mean, the beauty of working in drug discovery and development is the excitement of working with a range of different disciplines all together, because you have to have many different areas of expertise all coming together to deliver the right drug. But then, yes, 98-99% of all drugs that you start to develop will fail. So, I've been in this industry now for just over 30 years. I've had one drug go to market, about 9 that are in clinical trials at various points. Yeah. But some of those haven't made it, and they've dropped. Some have dropped out for poor translation into human efficacy. Some for some unknown safety issues that we just never picked up in the animal safety studies, in the early animal safety studies, but longer term animal safety studies you do. And others are, some for commercial reasons. Again, in the pharmaceutical industry, you may be pushing something all the way through, and then they'll have a complete change of mind in terms of where they're going to put their focus, and may actually then hold a compound. But you would hope, if it's looking good, some other organization may then still take that forward. But no, it's a challenging business, so there's a lot of hurdles to get things through. So, but it's a very rewarding business as well.
I can imagine. And do you feel that even when a drug doesn't make it through development, you still feel like you learn something each time that you can apply to the next project?
Absolutely. And I think, this is the trouble. You never, as a student, you never get taught drug discovery per se, and you can't bring everything together. It just comes with experience, because every single project has different challenges and different problems to overcome to be able to get to that new potential treatment. And, it's putting all those pieces together with time that sort of, project leaders, drug discovery and development project leaders that have been around for quite a period of time, are very, very sought after individuals because of the knowledge that they've gained over a wide range of diseases and therapies. I mean, every disease has a different challenge in terms of where we even have to get the drug to. And then when you're then developing the chemistry to deliver the new potential treatment, there's always different challenges associated with each one that you've got to try and overcome each time. So yeah, you won't get bored in this industry.
That's brilliant. And this drug is targeted towards malaria, and you mentioned in the introduction that malaria is quite a challenging disease to treat. How come? What's the reason why malaria is so difficult to treat?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's the disease itself so difficult to treat. It's more the fact that you've got to keep bringing forward new treatments for the disease because of the development of resistance to those treatments. I think, with a lot of these infectious diseases, this is the biggest challenge, in that you know, given time, sometimes fast, sometimes it takes a lot longer, yeah, they will ultimately develop resistance to those drugs. So we've got to keep bringing forward, you know, new high quality, safe, orally delivered therapies for these diseases on a continual basis, almost with differing modes of action, i.e. the way that they actually kill the parasites, so that you can then pair them up, because, you know, a lot of these diseases now, to try and combat the development of resistance quickly, is that they will be treated in combination. And as I was saying about when I updated on our drug 107498, you know, that's going into the patient trials, but it was doing it in combination with another drug straight away, and you've got to get the right properties of both of those drugs in that combination to be fairly similar so that they cover each other, because you don't want a very low level of that drug still circulating in the body with there's any parasites left, because then of course that creates, and they still survive, that then just creates the risk of resistance developing quicker than normal. So you want the properties in the two molecules to gel together beautifully so that all parasites are killed every time that combination of drugs is used, and that should hopefully slow down the onset of resistance.
And is there a fantastic, and you already mentioned one of them, but what are the other main challenges in discovering novel antimalarials?
Yeah, I think it's just by the fact that now, you know, over the last 10 years or so with the Medicines for Malaria venture, they've got a very healthy pipeline of potential new treatments for malaria, which is fantastic. You know, but the bar is quite high because of compliance, and particularly if you think of some of these settings in rural settings in Africa, it's quite challenging for people to keep coming backwards and forwards to the clinic for some of the diseases that we work on as well, not just malaria. You know, you ideally, a single pill that clears everything would be fantastic, because they don't forget to take it if they're taking one or two, three or four times a day. So, you know, the pressure is on to try and develop a single dose treatment for uncomplicated malaria. And, you know, I think our compound offers that, and we've proven it in the challenge study that it does work in that way because of the nature of how it behaves in the body. So that's good news. So there are challenges, but that's a development challenge. You know, a lot of other drug treatments, you know, you can give once or twice a day to people every day for however many weeks. And, you know, by doing it just to a single dose, that raises the bar in terms of the properties we have to develop in the chemistry to actually deliver the compound. So there are additional challenges associated with that. It's something we call the target product profile in any disease. It's what the clinicians ideally want, and that's what we try to adhere to. But sometimes, you know, that bar is higher or lower, but depending on what disease you're working on.
Absolutely. And when you look for drug targets for specific pathogens, is there an element of random chance to it, or is it very like, I know what I'm looking for, or is it more like, I think I know what I'm looking for, but then again, it might just be an element of random chance?
No, I mean, I think most of the success, certainly in the parasite space, has been with something we call phenotypic screening, mm-hmm. in terms of the start. So this is where you'll just take a large compound library, but small molecule compounds that have as much diversity as you can build in, but while still maintaining the types of properties that would allow you to develop them into a potential drug, and just screening those directly against the parasite to see if it kills them. That gives you then your chemical start point, and then you'll start working up from there. So, you know, most of the success has been in that phenotypic space, and that's pretty much because, you know, there's still a lack of sort of validated, pharmacologically validated targets for a lot of these parasite diseases. But
brilliant. And when you did the phenotypic screen for this drug, you used the Dundee protein kinase scaffold library. What is this scaffold library?
Yeah, so we have, so what you tend to have, you have, you know, it's the same in major pharmaceutical companies as well as in the drug discovery unit. You know, we have a range of different compound libraries. So we have sort of general libraries that just have chemical diversity in the small molecule space. And then we have sort of specific libraries, of which this one's a library of compounds that are put together because they have the structures within them that should hit protein kinases. And as you, you know, may know, the protein kinase family is you know, there's a range of potential. Well, there's a lot of, I mean, obviously a lot of these bugs have kinases, so actually we thought, okay, let's just start by screening the protein kinase library against these, against falciparum in the blood, in the asexual blood stage screening assay, and see what the, see if we can get any hits that could be the chemical start points that we need. And we did get the hits, and this is where our 107, our molecule that's in clinical trials, came from. But it wasn't a protein kinase. So even though in the protein kinase library, you know, it's not means that they're going to just hit only protein kinases. This clearly hits elongation factor two, as we found out subsequently through the deep sequencing of the mutants, and actually identifying the target from that. You know, working with the Sanger Institute down in Cambridge, which as well on that. So it was yeah. So although it started from a protein kinase library, it wasn't a protein kinase that was actually the target here in malaria. But it doesn't matter, because at that early stage, as I say, all you're after is you're trying to get interesting chemical start points to be able to start, you know, a drug discovery lead, hit to lead or lead optimization program.
Fantastic. And after you found the drug, you then refined it, and then after that you then tested it, and you said in the paper it had excellent activity against the parasites with an EC50 of 1 nanomoles and an EC99 of 2.4. What does EC50 and 99 mean?
Yeah, so in the simplest form, it's the effective concentration that gives you 50% maximal response, whatever that is, you know, whatever your target or your screen is. And then likewise, the EC99 or 99% maximal response, the effective concentration that delivers that. So here you could just look at it very simply in terms of you're killing 50% of those parasites in that well, or 99% of the parasites that are in that well. And of course, you know, we want to kill as many parasites as possible. So, and it's all part of, you know, with any disease, building a relationship between the drug exposure and the drug response. And, you know, for a lot of these diseases, we need to probably kill at least 90%, 99% or more, actually, to then, you know, for some diseases, the immune system will tidy up the rest of it. But other diseases you may, that hide from the immune system, like Chagas disease that we're working on, you have to kill every single parasite. So we're targeting drug levels that are the EC99 or greater in order to be effective, yeah.
Fantastic. And when you look at these numbers, are you looking for any particular concentration? Is it better to have a lower concentration to reach your EC50, EC99, or does it not matter that much?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously the lower the better, because then that puts less pressure on you in terms of the pharmacokinetic properties that you need in the body. So, I mean, if you've got to achieve heroic exposure in the person in order to be able to kill all the parasites, then you're running quite a significant risk that you may be hitting some other things in the body you might not want to at that higher concentration, and you could end up with some toxicologies that you want. So ideally, you know, the more potent, or the lower the concentration, the better. But, you know, the way we start this, we usually screen set concentration, because we just want those chemical start points first, as I keep referring to. So, you know, you might just screen against the parasite in wells first, say at 10 micromolar. Mm-hmm. But then with the actives, you then will do a concentration range to determine the EC50. But then you want to sort of push things down to get potency, I would say around 100 nanomolar or better. Right. And then that allows you, you know, some better opportunity in terms of developing the overall properties of the molecule to be successful, and ensuring that it's hopefully safe, because it's not hitting other receptors and ion channels and things that you don't want it to at those lower concentrations that are still effectively killing all the parasites.
Moving on to further on in the paper, you said that the candidate was very active in several mouse models of malaria. Since there's not always a great link between animal models and human models. Are they still good for predicting the effects in human trials?
Yeah, I mean, as it happens, then for these diseases, well, as we're developing the knowledge in these diseases, some of the diseases we're working on, we don't have much clinical data still to work with. So there is a leap of faith between the animal and human still, but the back translation will eventually help us there. But if we're focusing specifically on malaria here, then yes, there's been a lot of data now to understand and develop this pharmacokinetic pharmacodynamic relationship, and understanding that actually that the animal models that they use now are very effective in terms of the translation through to the human disease. So, you know, more often than not, you end up using mice initially for as these disease initial disease models. And of course, you know, the mouse malaria is something called Plasmodium bergii, but actually then there may be a disconnect between that and falciparum, the human most mortal form that you want to, or the causes of most mortality, I should say, that you were trying to treat. So they developed what we call a sort of humanized mouse model. So, you know, this is using, you know, an uncompromised, strongly immunocompromised mouse that you then allow to have human erythrocytes circulating around it, so that you actually have falciparum within that mouse growing. And it's that model that, you know, was developed that actually is offering, you know, very good PK/PD and translation through to the clinic now. So we feel pretty confident, certainly with all the molecules that are going forward and now in the clinic, to allow you to refine and back translate the disease model, that actually the pathway to the clinic in malaria now is very good.
Brilliant.
But that's not always the case with a lot of other diseases still yet.
Yeah. Fantastic. And to summarize what we've discussed today, what do you feel was the most important things that you learned from this paper? And as we said before, you learn something from every project, and thankfully this was touch wood, a successful project. What's the most important things you feel that you learned from this?
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, I just take immense pride from actually delivering this this molecule, working with a great team of people. You know, Professor Ian Gilbert and Dr. Beatrice Baragna. You know, we've been a very effective team, and you know, it was the first clinical candidate for the drug discovery unit, so it was a huge flag for us in terms of, you know, validating the drug discovery unit from the day that it was first developed. That actually, you know, but we now have, you know, five drugs that have been into the clinic, so in different diseases. So, you know, the drug discovery unit is doing some great stuff now. But yeah, I mean, it had some development challenges, this compound. I mean, I learned a lot around the resistance potential and how we can try it, and know how we needed to manage that in malaria. I mean, you know, I came from the central nervous system field in terms of development. I hadn't ever worked in anti-infectives in Glaxo, so actually, you know, learning the drug discovery path in terms of, you know, what's needed for anti-infectives was obviously key for me in terms of developing drugs in a way that they're going to have the right pharmacokinetic properties in the body. Yes, that's the same in any disease, you know, apart from obviously where you need to target them to as well, which has additional challenges. But no, in malaria, there was, you know, there were some challenges around getting oral absorption once you've taken that tablet good enough, and we went through several rounds of chemistry to fix that while still retaining the desirable attributes that it had in killing the malaria parasites as well. So there was what I would say more usual drug discovery challenges in terms of developing the chemistry appropriately, but no, I learned a lot in terms of actually what's needed to develop the additional things that are needed to develop a drug for malaria. And subsequently, you know, we have another very active program in that space, and you know, we were awarded the MNV Project of the Year in 2018 for the current program that we're working. And this is a target-based program rather than a phenotypic program, from which the one we've just been talking about arose from. And you know, hopefully we will deliver a new candidate to go into the portfolio for malaria from this target-based program soon. And you know, we're much more informed in terms of what we need to do in this space now from that. So there's, yeah, lots of learnings all the time.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us today.
No, it's a pleasure. So.
Thank you. I'll stop recording there. One second. Stop recording.